بدأنا بسم الله وبالصلاة الله على رسول الله وآله
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the radio show looking for truth wherever it may be. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking with a great variety of guests who will tell it like it is on all kinds of interesting issues. This show today is my Eid special. It's Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice, the biggest single holiday in Islam, one of the two great Eids or great holidays, the other being the feast at the end of the Ramadan fast. So today, as we prepare to celebrate the Eid al-Adha, there are Eid prayers beginning to happen all over the world. And over in Mecca, the spiritual center of Islam, the place toward which Muslims turn when they pray, the rites of Hajj are beginning, that is the pilgrimage. And we're going to talk about that with somebody I would call a leading American expert on the Hajj pilgrimage, Michael Wolf. Michael Wolf is an American Muslim who's written some terrific stuff on the Hajj. His books, The Hajj, An American's Pilgrimage to Mecca, and 1,000 Roads to Mecca, 10 Centuries of Travelers Writing About the Muslim Pilgrimage, are absolute go-to top-shelf books, maybe the first books to look at if you're interested in learning more about the Hajj pilgrimage that's going on right now. So without further ado, let's let Michael Wolf tell us about the Hajj. Hey, Michael, welcome. And what is this Hajj, anyway?
Oh, well, thank you. Nice to be here, Kevin. The answer to that question could go on for some time, but I'll try to be simple and straightforward about this. The Hajj is the Islamic religion's annual pilgrimage. It is a pilgrimage, in this case, to Mecca. If Christians wanted to think of this, they might think of it as partly a retreat. And in some cases, they might think of a place like Lourdes or, another area where people go to seek respite and gather together and perhaps even be healed a bit spiritually. The Hajj is historically one of mankind's most enduring rites. It has been going on more or less unbroken for 1,400 years. It has provided a spiritual destination to millions of men and women around the globe. Its attractive power has outlasted great empires. It's shaped trade routes through half the world. It's persisted despite war and famine and plague. And today, it's probably the greatest public rite that occurs annually around religion that I know of anyway. Over 2 million Muslims attend this over a week long, or sometimes they come a lot earlier than that, but at least a week long period. They come from around 180 different countries every year. And it probably is, as I said, the largest single gathering in one place at one time for one purpose that occurs every year on the planet.
And that's a lot of people, 2 million people. To try and get a handle on what that's like, having all those people in one place kind of doing the same thing, that's the very biggest football or baseball stadiums in the U.S. hold well under 100,000 people, I believe. Maybe more likely sort of in the 50,000 range. So we're talking about, 20, many dozens of times more people kind of in one place than you would get in the biggest American stadium with a packed, jam-packed sporting event. That's a lot of people. How can so many people be accommodated in performing whatever? Essentially, it's the same right for everybody.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're correct in your observation. This is, I don't know how times 20 or 30 or 50, the Super Bowl. And people are there for quite a long time. And, you know, it's not a 3-hour game. The accommodation is primarily of two sorts. Part of it takes place in an urban area.
You know, Michael, we're getting some static on the line. I don't know if you're bumping the microphone or something, but...
I'm sorry.
Okay, that's a little better. Okay, please talk straight into the microphone.
Okay. Part of this is an urban right. Takes place in the middle of a fairly large city, which is well organized for this particular event. And, you know, the people in that town start about 3 months ahead getting ready for this event. So there's a lot of preparation and a lot of organization that goes into it. And it's all managed through embassies and by visas and so on. So its intake control is pretty elaborate. There are huge airports, I think the largest airports in the world nearby. I think it's fair to say that a jumbo jet lands every minute for, some days and weeks during this period. So there's a lot of food, and there's a lot of traffic control, and a lot of hotels and rentable apartments, and people also camp out. Many people camp out. And then there's a kind of countryside period when people actually leave that city behind. It's basically deserted for 3 or 4 days. And people troop out into a desert area about 5 miles away. And there are tents set up, thousands, tens of thousands of tents, rather large tents. And quite a few of them are air conditioned these days because it's very hot there too. And there's a whole system of organizing this tent city, which really does go on for miles when you can get up on a hillside and overlook it. The expanse is pretty breathtaking. So, just summing up, there's a lot of effort goes into this, a lot of man hours and women hours, a lot of marketing and food and a lot of walking as well. And now there are trains as well that go from one spot to another. So a lot of transportation too.
And of course, this is all, it's part of the Eid festivities, the Feast of the Sacrifice, which commemorates God staying the hand of Abraham. And in Islam, the son who was not sacrificed is Ishmael in English, as opposed to Isaac in the Jewish version. And I suppose the two themes there are one, the sort of absolute submission to God, which was a characteristic of the prophet Abraham, or Ibrahim, as we say in Islam. And then another theme is kind of the end of human sacrifice. That's a kind of a buried theme. At that time, of course, there was a lot of actual child sacrifice in some of the pagan religions, and so this is the kind of the centerpiece of why people are doing this at this time. But also, there's another aspect of this Hajj ritual, which is a sort of unity, right? Tawheed in Islam is making it oneness, unity. God is one, and so everyone turns in the same direction to face the same Qibla to pray, and then everyone, whether they're rich or poor, from whatever country or culture, comes to the same place to do this pilgrimage.
Well, those are two very interesting themes you brought up. You know, the first part reminds me to maybe just want to say a little something about how, well, you mentioned Abraham, you mentioned Ishmael, you mentioned Isaac, and some of our listeners may not actually immediately be aware that, Islam is very closely allied and related to the Torah The sacred books of the Jewish people and the sacred books of the Christians as well. And this is something that in current day politics and so on, people lose sight of. But in fact, a Muslim would not mention the name Jesus, for instance, without saying peace be upon him, just as he would do the same with Ibrahim or Abraham. Or Muhammad. All of these figures are, powerful, prophetic characters who play a major role in Islam's theology and liturgy and in practice. So the Hajj itself is really like opening a book and reading, enacting stories written there. The stories of Abraham and his journey into the desert, his wife Hagar and his child by her, Ishmael. All of this is these are all well-known stories to anyone who reads the sacred books of the Jews or the Christians, which is most Americans. So it's kind of, I was always attracted by that notion that Islam is really the third panel, the third side of a triptych, in a way, a prophetic monotheistic religion that has its roots in exactly the same territory as Christianity and Judaism do too. And springs out of the same substrate, the same spiritual and cultural background. So, in addition, you mentioned this notion of unity, and the Hajj is, I have been on the Hajj several times, and the first thing that you notice, you can't help but notice, is that the Hajj is like travel without a passport. I mean, there really are people from everywhere there. And they're all of the men dressed in two white cloths. There is meant to erase any distinctions of culture, nation, economy, or stature. A king and a pauper really look exactly the same during the Hajj. And the women are all in very plain forms of their own local dress. So it's a very powerful symbol of this kind of we're all here together, and we're dressed in such simple ways that you really can't tell where we're from or who we are. We are all God's children in that respect. So it's a very powerful experience to see that kind of leveling of all of the differences that we are so tuned in to registering in our daily social lives, and to have a week or so, sometimes 2 or 3 weeks, to think about larger things than all of the differences between us, to think about some of the common ground, some of the similarities. So both of those items that you mentioned, both those topic areas, are really powerfully expressed in the Hajj.
Indeed. And Malcolm X is perhaps the source that most Americans would be the most familiar with as far as addressing that issue of the kind of getting away from differences and having a place of total human equality at the Hajj. And you did collect, as one of the many wonderful pieces of writing about the Hajj that you have in 1,000 Roads to Mecca, you included Malcolm X's description of the Hajj, which of course turned his life around and led to his embracing a more universal conception of Islam than he had had before.
Yeah, the literature of the pilgrimage to Mecca is for Americans dominated by Malcolm X's passage, one chapter in his autobiography, which was a best-selling book for and remains a kind of cornerstone of African-American literature and American literature too. So there is that, you know, very, very famous journey. Of course, Muhammad Ali, you know, probably the most famous Muslim in America, has been on Hajj several times, and so have a lot of other Americans. I think about 10 to 15,000 American Muslims go to Mecca every year, different ones, of course. You know, it's done, the population of the Hajj is divvied up based on the Muslim representation in each country. So it's a very small representation. In the United States, tops would be 8 million Muslims. In the U.S., some say there are only 3 or 4. I have no idea. I don't count. I'm not apprised of what the real number of Muslims is. And we don't count by religion in the United States, so really nobody knows. But the Hajj will have, you know, much larger populations from, say, India, where although Islam is a minority religion in India, nonetheless, 200 million Muslims, that's quite a minority in a country of over a billion. So there's a much larger Hajj population coming from India. The more visas are issued. So that's kind of how the numbers are both divvied up and also controlled. 2 million is about the current population, but that's down from probably more like 3.5 million in the 90s before they began to control it. You know, they had a number of years on the Hajj when things were kind of, it wasn't that the Hajj was dangerous, but it was so overcrowded that accidents kept happening. And they became more the news about the Hajj than the Hajj. So they the controlling interests in the pilgrimage, the people who actually handle the technology and the logistics of the Hajj, lowered the number of people allowed to come each year. And it's been a big improvement. 2 million is still a lot, but Mecca's a big city, and so is the area outside of town where a number of the rites were also performed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Mecca. It's one of the great cities of human civilization, and I would argue Western civilization as well. In the humanities, we often hear about Athens and Jerusalem being the two cities from which Western culture springs, but we should really have Mecca in there too. It's Athens, Mecca, and Jerusalem, because Mecca, in a sense, is part of Jerusalem. It's part of the religious heritage of Western civilization. And it's been, in some sense, perhaps artificially cut off from the rest of Western civilization due to prejudices and historical accidents. But the city of Mecca itself is such a fascinating place with such a fascinating history. And there has been some criticism of the Saudi authorities for not being sufficiently attuned to the historical value of Mecca, as they've bulldozed historical places to put up high rises and things like that. Ziadine Sardar has written eloquently about this. So there's a whole sort of cityscape and city history angle to Mecca that's very interesting, which you cover in your work.
Let's begin with the location. You know, Mecca lies kind of midway, lies kind of midway along the west coast of Arabia. It looks down toward the Red Sea. It's in a mountainous kind of barrier region, really, called the Hejaz. That barrier region is no joke. I mean, there is a reason why Mecca has been hard to get to, hard to reach, and never really a great trading center in the history of the world. It's a tough place to get to from the Mediterranean, and it's a tough place to get to from India too. It is a rather barren landscape. If you get up into the more mountainous regions, it becomes looks a lot more like New England. But Mecca itself is in a basin in desert. It's become a modern city of over a million people now. It has all the amenities, but it still does feel a little provincial compared to, say, Jeddah, which is only 50 miles away, the major Red Sea port that it's sometimes attached to or connected with. It's always been a pilgrimage center long before Islam. You know, Islam's only, we say, 1,400 years old and change, but people have been coming to Mecca on pilgrimage, apparently, since the days of Abraham. And that's going back to 2000 BC. The dress that people still wear when they enter Mecca, these two cloths that I spoke of, the white cloths, are a uniform of sorts, a pilgrim's uniform of sorts, which you can see on sculptures in the very ancient traditions of the Middle East, going back 2,000 or 3,000 years. So actually more than that, going back 3,000 or 4,000 years. The city itself is ancient as a site where a well was located and where people came every year and where to celebrate the spiritual and where aggression and war were stopped for 3 months. That every year. That did improve the trading potential of Mecca because there was no raiding during that period. During the pilgrimage period, all violence was called off. And this was in a very violent time in some cases, you know, when raiding and pillaging was kind of the order of the day. So it was always a very unusual place, with certain laws that governed it, laws that tended toward the peaceful. And it has a real history and even prehistory of that as its character.
Right. And before the Islamic pilgrimage was instituted, there was a pilgrimage there that was apparently part of, as you said, there was a cessation of warfare and a lot of trading. And this was the pagan Meccans who were profiting from that. And indeed, it was their increasingly profitable oligarchy that was partly based on control of that pilgrimage that went up against early Islam and was a part of the context of what was a sort of a social as well as a religious revolution in the direction of human equality that Islam brought.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's a story that's, of great interest to, I would think, to modern people, because it is an example of an individual and a small group who pushed back against an oligarchy, an elite, a handful of families who were raking off the profits and keeping most of the society in rags.
And the more things change, the more they stay the same, huh?
Yeah. So as I say, I think modern. You know, I often think of this in not only I, but so did Nelson Mandela think of this. He actually comments upon this occasionally. Mandela and his small group of revolutionaries, really, trying to acquire a little more equity for the population, bears a lot of resemblance to what was going on in this period in Mecca during Muhammad's day. And he was actually run out of town eventually, he and his group. He was threatened with suicide. He was cut off in his community for 3 years with no trading allowed and very little food getting into his section of town.
Wait a minute. You said he was threatened with suicide? You mean like today, I know they tried to kill him.
That's what I meant.
Because today, you know, on some of the issues I cover, we have whistleblowers and police investigators like Elric Fredou, who is investigating a hot clue about Charlie Hebdo being an inside job the very night of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and he was suicided as a transitive verb.
I used the wrong word. I didn't mean anything about suicide. I meant that his life was threatened on a number of occasions.
Right.
And eventually he left town. He was run out of town. He later returned, and things changed markedly in Mecca. But the history of Mecca and Medina is much more interesting than most people know. And nonetheless, it's all in online and in the Britannica and, you know, encyclopedias if you want to read about it. But it makes for a place that has a very inspiring history, and of course it is the place where Islam first emerged in the Arab culture. You know, Islam looks back to, I should let your listeners know, a kind of perennial religion. This is why Muslims look back to Abraham. They look back to the founder of monotheism. They look back to an ethical monotheism, which originally went unnamed, but people embraced it. And there were, a few people called the Hanafi who at that time, even in that part of Arabia, were awake to this notion. But Muhammad, the prophet, is a prophet because he was able to reshape this ancient vision of ethical monotheism into something that his people could embrace and understand. He essentially infused God's word, if you will, into the Arabic and, not Mediterranean cultures, let's say. And it very easily traveled around the world because of that, because it really was this essential faith that he was reinvigorating. The story is pretty well told in a tiny little book by Karen Armstrong, her second. She wrote two books. This is, I'm speaking of the wonderful British historian who's alive and well and writing, the author of The History of God and many other books. Wrote a little book you can hold in the palm of your hand. It might be 150 pages long, called The Life of Muhammad. And it's the second one I'm referring to. But it tells this story in very clear historical terms. And your listeners might, some of them who like to read, might enjoy checking it out.
Yes, I do recommend Karen Armstrong's writings as among the very best of what you can get in English on this topic, as well as yours. And Karen Armstrong is a former nun who now describes herself as a freelance monotheist. She hasn't called herself a Muslim, but I guess she's more in line with the Hanafis that you mentioned. These were people who looked back to a kind of, as you said, a primordial monotheism that's not really affiliated with a particular sect or school of thought. And Abraham was the sort of primordial Hanafi or pure monotheist. And this leads us to that issue of how Islam is somewhat different from its sibling monotheisms in that it does seem to sort of purify, or perhaps you could say simplify, the notion of monotheism. In place of a holy trinity, there's just God is one. And in place of a fallen world and fallen humankind, a perfect God would only make a perfect creation, and we've just kind of forgotten that. That's our real sin, is just forgetfulness. Basically, Islam seems to sort of straighten things out and in a sense kind of condense them or simplify them. The stories from the earlier prophets retold in Quran are in some cases perhaps not as elaborate in a literary way as, for instance, the story of Job in the Jewish Bible, the Torah, But the it's simplified, condensed, and sort of the straightforward lesson of this is what this means in a world created by one God, a God who's one, a perfect God, means. So I know you came to Islam, I believe, at a point in your when you were already an adult. You must have been thinking about religions before that. So what did lead you to this path?
Well, you know, by the time I was about 18, coming out of a family that was a Christian mother and a Jewish father, and both of them pretty much in flight from their religious backgrounds, I didn't really have much interest in religion at all. I would say zero. My spiritual life was tied up in poetry and writing and travel and friends and, you know, leading a good life. I was a very secular person. I only really began to see a point to religion in my 40s when I underwent a kind of, I don't know, I would call it a sort of drying up in my life, you know. Kind of cynicism and had answers for everything, but wasn't getting much satisfaction out of it. That kind of overthinking and underfeeling kind of life. And at that time, I had already spent a certain amount of time personally, I mean years, in North Africa and in various Muslim countries, not because they were Muslim. I was there because I was there. But I was surrounded by them, and I knew a bit about Islam as a result. And when I hit this patch in my life of really a kind of dry patch, I remembered the way Muslims had treated me, which was unfailingly hospitable. And very generous and kind. And I also remembered the bit of the experience around Muslims that I had had. So I kind of, you know, I put my Islam together by myself. I wasn't anywhere near a mosque or anything. I was living out in the country. But I did learn the prayer. And that really sustained me for a year or two. I didn't really need to go on. I learned the Muslim prayer, which is a kind of a little more athletic than the Christian or the Jewish prayers.
Kind of, it's almost a yoga postures.
Well, and I was having some problems with my back. You know, I had been in an auto accident, and this standing up straight and then bending over and kneeling down and putting my forehead to the ground and so on, did have I was improving doing this. And, you know, in a sense, I've been kind of adding on to what I would refer to as my Islam ever since. I'm never going to, quote unquote, catch up to someone who was born in this religion. It's a very rich tradition, you know, hundreds of thousands of great texts I will never read, 183 countries, most of which I will never see. But, you know, it's also a very, to me, it's like a little bit like a spiritual toolkit, a very small one with not very many moving parts, which I appreciate. And I use that to keep myself sane and working cleanly. And that's what Islam has become for me. You know, they did a study 20 or 30 years ago trying to ascertain by taking a poll among tens of thousands of people over the world, what is Islam? And ultimately, all they could come up with that everyone agreed upon was that it was monotheistic and had something to do with Muhammad. And in that he delivered a kind of condensed message that is quite available to anyone who's Christian or Jewish. You would find it very familiar, believe me. So that's interesting to me that there are, you know, I think it's fair to say that Islam is a world religion, 1.5 billion people, I would say, more or less. That's a huge number of people. 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people on the planet is a Muslim. And you can just imagine when you line 10 people up and ask them what's what, you get 10 different answers. Well, you know, among Muslims, you're going to get a lot of different answers too. And mine is just one of them.
Indeed. That's a fascinating aspect of Islam, is the way it's spread all over the world, and it's so different at the, you know, from culture to culture, country to country, and indeed individual to individual. And that ties in with your books on the Hajj, the issue of tying together these people from all of these different cultures, countries, so many different types of individuals, all coming and sharing this experience. And not only the Hajj, but there's a kind of a dimension of sacred travel in Islam where the Hajj is the center of it. But there's a tradition also of rehla, which means traveling. There's rehla Taliban al-ilm, the travel in search of knowledge. And this far-flung civilization of so many different cultures that spread all the way around the world seems to thrive and be based in, to a certain extent, in the travel that brings people together.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, equally true is the fact that half of the Muslims in the world live outside of Muslim-majority countries, many of them in Europe and the United States and Canada and Australia. You know, this has been a diasporic religion in the 20th century, as well as a global religion, which it already was in the Middle Ages. There are, many Muslims who no longer live in what you would think of as the traditional lands of Islam. And there are going to be many more. So this is a period when Islam is moving around the globe in new and different ways. Well, and so isn't everything, you know? I mean, travel is so easy. And relocation out of a chaotic or oppressive or financially unrewarding area into some other more promising territory is these days fairly easy to accomplish compared to 500 years ago. So we're seeing a lot of spreading out, and the pollen is being blown about all over the world, the spiritual pollen of the world. So, you know, we have Tibetans living in Santa Cruz, California, and we have Muslims living in Texas, lots of them. So, you know, this is just the world we are living in now is various, and the notion that in a matter of a month as many people could flood into Europe as have from states that will no longer allow them to send their children to school or live without fear of stray bullets killing them is really phenomenal. This is a period of flight. 60 million people are leaving their homes, are living in chaotic situations and trying to leave them. And, you know, Islam is all mixed up in this because Islam is a global religion. It's not a regional faith. So the business of travel, I mean, I've written 2 travel books that are rooted in Islam. But for me, the most fascinating thing is how Islam itself is traveling now. You know, many of its great centers are laboring under dictatorships in the Middle East, particularly in cities that are falling apart. There's a beautiful mosque here or there, and it's hard to get to because of the problems in that city. Damascus is a perfect example. You may still understand that one of the two or three most beautiful mosques in the world is in Damascus, but you probably will not want to go to visit it right now.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And this kind of traveling that we're seeing today, which Islam is all mixed up in, is also a part of this this context of fear of Islam that we're seeing, especially in the West. It seems that Islam has taken on the kind of the reputation as the great other, perhaps even the enemy for some, and a much smaller number see it more as a solution than a problem. There are sort of two visions, I think, of Islam coming into the West. One, the one that influenced me very much when I discovered it around 1990, or actually 89, was the vision of the traditionalist school of thought, which was founded by René Guénon. He and others believed that Western civilization had grown decadent and overly materialistic, and that Christianity had declined to the point that the logical way back to its true spiritual roots would be through Islam. And so he and others did come to Islam, and that is a vision of the West being renewed spiritually by Islam. But today, in the mainstream media and elsewhere, we see people who are terrified of Islam coming to the West. They imagine that the Muslims in Texas are going to turn into ISIS monsters, cutting off people's heads. Can you comment a bit about the contrast between these sort of two opposing visions of Islam coming to the West?
Well, I think we have two problems here. You know, one is it's not the 21st century everywhere in the world, either mentally, socially, or physically. So we have we sit in a fairly modern country, and we tend to judge from top down. You know, we have a way of looking at other people in which we take our best side and compare it to their worst. And, you know, this is a kind of provincialism and a kind of intellectual laziness that we all participate in from time to time. You know, we need to sort of straighten up our act a little bit, I think. The world is a big, big place, and there are more and more people coming from it here, which has been historically the renewing factor in keeping America fresh and young. That is the history of this country more than the history of any other country on the globe. That is the history of America. So it's incumbent upon us, if we're going to be reasonable, good Americans in the tradition of the founding fathers, to welcome others, not to create a fortress around us. That is actually not in the spirit of traditional America at all. So there's that. There's what time is it? You know, it's the 15th century in some places. And I don't mean just physically and geographically, but mentally and socially as well. And this whole imaginary wishing back to a golden age that never existed, which is the power, the imaginary power of a group like ISIS, longing back for a caliphate, longing back for a world in the 7th century that really never was that great. Believe me, the story of Muhammad proves that it was not that great. So, you know, this is a kind of a fantasy that is being foisted upon young people, especially as, you know, the recruiters get out there for these ridiculous, frightening organizations like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which really are not millenarian at all. I mean, to me, The religious aspect of ISIS, the religious aspect of Al-Qaeda, that's decoration. That's all it is. It's a means by which to convince people that you have been underwritten by a great religion. It's a lie. So to be able to separate the false from the true is also the second piece that I think we all need to be able to sharpen up our game a little bit here. We act very innocent about this, but we shouldn't act innocent about it. We all have had experience of this kind of thing. We had the Ku Klux Klan in this country. We know what using religion to fake people out with is about. That's part of our history, too. And the Ku Klux Klan came out of a failed civil war. When I say failed, I don't mean that the war itself didn't accomplish great things. But when we garrisoned the South and the Midwest for 10 years and forced people who were not ready yet to change their ways 100%, the reaction was violent and frightening. And we got Jesse James in our history as a result, and many others. So, this is not mysterious, what's going on in ISIS. This is the fallout of a civil war that failed miserably. And the people who had power want it back. It's as simple as that. It's a resurgent group. And they're using religion to get what they want. These, in many cases, are the generals and colonels of Saddam Hussein, who were forced out of power in 2004, 5, and 6, and who are now back. And they're using religion as a set of tools to pry their way back into power. So don't be fooled. I'm talking to your listeners now. I'm not talking to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Nope, I'm talking to your listeners. Don't be fooled, because these people are really trying to fool you. And don't confuse this relative handful of sour and very materialistic people, by the way. These are not religious people. They're very materialistic people. They want lots of money and oil and young girls. That's what they want. And they're showing it very clearly. So don't be fooled, and don't confuse these criminals with the vast majority of Muslims who really are peace-loving people.
Well, I tried to make the point, and I did make the point, actually, in some of my talks on the new book.
Muslims are the biggest victim of all of this by far. It's the Muslims who are being murdered. We have some terror to live with. We have some people who have died. We have some terrible situations that have been created by these folks. But meanwhile, in places like Iraq and Syria and Jordan, and just go, the list is long. You can go into Africa, northern Nigeria. The Boko Haram and Somalia, and the list goes on. It's a long list. They're all Muslim countries. These are Muslims who are suffering in the tens and hundreds of thousands, millions, really, if you talk about displacement and being homeless. So, recognize also who's suffering here. We're all suffering, including the Muslim. This is Muslim on Muslim violence.
And then the question arises. Yeah, well, no, that was a wonderful discourse. But the question arises, to what extent is some of this being actually promoted by forces that want to weaken the Islamic awakening? For example, I just had my wife, who's a Muslima from Morocco, she was very, very upset at this guy, Anjum Chowdhury, who's kind of a pro-Al-Qaeda and somewhat pro-ISIS guy over in the UK who gets tons of mainstream media publicity. USA Today invited this guy, who's a total nobody. He has no scholarly credentials, nothing. He's just a guy who's gone out with a sign in public and waved it a few times. And he gets invited to submit an op-ed to USA Today, which is marginally literate. Why is somebody like Anjem Choudhury all over the Western mainstream media, giving his simplistic pro-Al-Qaeda rant, when the polls show that 80% of Muslims worldwide know that 9/11 was an inside job, that Al-Qaeda's popularity ratings never got above 15%, and currently, when an Islamophobic group tried to do a poll to show that Muslims support ISIS, and they tweaked the questions and worked as hard as they could, they couldn't get up to 5% support for ISIS. So this is just one of, of so many examples suggesting that it seems that the West in general, and maybe some of its more devious leaders in particular, actually want to foster this retrograde pseudo-Islam. Of course, they'll call that a conspiracy theory, but that doesn't mean it's not true.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I find that whole problem, first of all, out of my hands, and secondly, the media is a business. The media is one of the biggest businesses in the world, and the prime rule of the media is: if it bleeds, it leads. If it frightens you, it sells papers or advertising or whatever it is you're selling. So, you know, there's a lot of the fear market is a big market. It's good for selling guns. It's good for beefing up armies. It's good for a lot of things. But in truth, I do not subscribe to conspiracy theories at all. And I don't think 9/11 was any kind of an inside job. I think it was a group of people who wanted to take over Saudi Arabia as quickly as possible. They wanted the oil fields. They wanted what they wanted. And it became international later. That's Al-Qaeda, I mean. It became an international group later. And they saw a chance to make a big splash with very little power at hand. And they took it. And we were a bit asleep at the switch, too. You know, I mean, our entire system, the police were not talking to the FBI. The FBI wasn't talking to the CIA, quite the opposite.
Excuse me, Michael. You know? Can I interrupt you just for a moment? I don't know where to start, but Susan Lindauer, a CIA go-between between the U.S., the CIA, and Iraq, knew, well, she was told by her CIA controller that it was coming, that Lower Manhattan was going to be attacked in late August, early September. She should stay out of there. And on 9/11 itself, she was actually on the phone with this with her CIA case officer, a man named Richard Fuse, who was later paid $10 million in hush money. Richard Fuse, as he and Susan were watching the towers exploding, Fuse started screaming, "The goddamn Israelis, the goddamn Israelis." And so Susan Lindauer is only one of dozens and dozens of insider whistleblowers who fully exposed that indeed 9/11 was an inside job. And I know we don't have time to go into this. We're at the very end of the hour. But yeah, I'd be happy to send you a short look.
Very little here. I don't believe all of that's true, you see. So that's just me. I don't believe it. I think there's a counter story.
You wouldn't believe it even if
you called me and asked me, so I'm telling you what I think. But actually, you know, this is far, far from the question of the Hajj. You know, this is like out in a kind of politicized area that I don't have any real authority to speak in anyway. I mean, you know, I'm just giving you my opinion here.
And that's fair.
I do also think that my main concern for my country, for the United States, is that in protecting ourselves, we don't poison our own will. We don't so limit our own rights and our own freedom of speech. And our own right to say what we think, regardless of what it might be, and not go to jail, which is a great gift this country gives people, by and large. I know there are plenty of
I was robbed of $2 million in projected lifetime earnings by Republican state legislators who felt that my research on 9/11 was unacceptable. And so I'm alive, barely. But frankly, I'm not very impressed by the level of free speech we have. It's true that you can say things on internet radio that you probably wouldn't be able to say in certain other countries. But I'm not sure how long we'll be able to do that.
Well, see, I wouldn't put a but after that sentence. I've been in Egypt recently, and I know that how many, you know, there are tens of thousands of people in jail in Egypt put there in the last, you know, short period for daring to breathe a little opposition into the situation.
Indeed, thousands have been killed.
Yeah. So, you know, it's that contrast that I'm trying to draw. I don't believe that any country is perfect, and I do believe that there's a lot of work to do in the United States, and I do think it's a terrifying thing when a professor cannot publish his research and continue to keep his job or get a new one. But the degree to which that happens elsewhere and the degree to which, in general, I personally have been able to speak and say what I think, makes me, I'm not negative about this country. What I want to see in this country is that we don't blow it. What I would like to see is that we don't so over-defend ourselves against another bogeyman, as we were doing when I was just growing up as a little kid, and we were so terrified of Khrushchev banging his shoe in the UN. Russia turned out to be a paper tiger, and, we overestimate the problems the challenges, the enemies that we create. So that's what I don't want to see happen here.
And, likewise, we can certainly agree on that.
Yeah, and I fear that it is happening. So, the Muslim situation is in the United States is right now the litmus test of it. It will be somebody else in 50 years. And, you know, we have a history of creating enemies and then going after them. And when we don't, we consider our leaders to be lily-livered and not real men or something. So I would like to see, an alteration, in our attitude.
Okay, likewise. So thank you so much, Michael Wolff. We've hit the end of the hour, but I appreciate your terrific work in your travel writings, your 1,000 Roads to Mecca, and your book, The Hajj. These are wonderful introductions to the topic of the Hajj, and I hope to have you back again. If you send me your address, I'll send you a slim book of mine that you may or may not find interesting, but either way, thank you, God bless you. And keep up the great work.
Oh, thank you very much, Kevin. I'd love to come back. It's always fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.